deeper understanding of the workings of the South Africa Human Rights Commission, what still needs to be done at the Human Rights Commission. And I also know the challenges that the Human Rights Commission has got. And I think I could offer I think there's a lot to offer because of all the information that I have and having observed the direction that the Human Rights Commission has been taking and also the developments in the country. So I think there's a lot that needs to be contributed, that I can contribute to the Human Rights Commission.
Thank you very much. Where do we start? Yes, Honorable Sartan. Follow.
Welcome.
Just a minute. How do you go about? Do we ask questions and get answers, or do we ask first rounds of questions? One question, one answer.
One on one.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Please. Yeah. Let's go.
Thank you very much and welcome, Master. You must see that I've been in Parliament as well. Can I just ask you? I see you were the CEO until 2005, and we are aware, obviously, in terms of the ad hoc report, that there was a lot of internal dissent in the and that this led to your resignation in 2005. Could you just comment on how you now, as a commissioner, sorry, this doesn't seem to be working.
How you, as a commissioner, would then deal with internal dissent and how you would see it differently? Clearly, there was an open letter addressed to the Speaker of the National Assembly, 15 staff members, and understand correctly that was the reason for your resignation as the CEO, amongst other reasons, at the end of 2005. Maybe you'd like to comment on that, and how you would take the Commission forward. That's the first issue. Secondly, one of the main issues that we have been faced with when the Commission reports to us is the difficulty that the Commission has in obtaining answers from the executive on complaints, on, for example, promotion of access to information. And there's been huge frustrations. How would you deal with an executive or department that do not respond to complaints, do not respond to requests from the Commission as a commissioner? We know that you've got to write a subpoena, but how else can you, obviously that doesn't seem to have helped you. There are powers in the Act. How would you deal with that that issue? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Salt. I'm happy to have this opportunity. I think I just want to start by saying that the problems at the Commission were not personal problems. They were governance issues. Governance issues which emanated from structural problems. And the Honourable Member quotes the Professor Asmal report. And I'm aware that report does go quite deep into the structural problems that are there. And I just want to, for the record, say that when I left the Human Rights Commission, I was the longest serving CEO in those institutions. The other people don't stay that long. The problems at the Human Rights Commission, when I left, there were no issues of money. Money hasn't been abused, no issues of not doing work, no issues of, there were no issues of misbehavior or anything. All the issues were around governance issues. And I'm hoping that some of those recommendations would be implemented speedily, because the various policy documents that were used and were in conflict created much of the strife amongst people who otherwise would have been very good teammates. I was very lucky. I had very good commissioners, but the structural issues played us against each other. We had the Human Rights Commission Act, which said the chairperson of the commission was the authority, and they had a whole lot of issues that in the Public Finance Management Act were put in the hands of the CEO. So there was a lack of clarity in terms of the roles that each one had to play, and lack of clarity in terms, even in simple things like who reports to Parliament. The Public Finance Management Act says you are responsible for the use of the budget, for how the budget has been spent, you report to Parliament. The Human Rights Act says the chairperson is the head of the institution, is the person that, it says the commission, but we understand that the commission is led by the chairperson, reports to Parliament. So there were all those kinds of issues like that which brought about strife. As for staff resigning, I never had a single one of the people that reported to me resigning, not one. So the people that had resigned were in the other parts of the commission. None of the people that reported to me resigned. It's very difficult to be able to say I would have left because of the people that had resigned in other parts of the commission, because of the way the commission was operating when they were actually so far removed from reporting to me. Not that as CEO you wouldn't be concerned, you would be concerned definitely, but you would not resign because of people who are in other areas of the commission and not reporting to you. So that is not the reason I resigned. I resigned because the lack of clarity had brought about so much tension between us. And I do want to emphasize that under different circumstances, if there wasn't that situation, I was very lucky to work with very good and very knowledgeable people, for the record. Now, when it comes to answers from the executive, as the years went by, there was something called reporting fatigue from the government departments. The government departments indicated just how much reporting they had to do. The honorable member asked me how I would deal with that if I were to go back to the Human Rights Commission as a commissioner. I think firstly we need to, much of the work that the departments have to report on is also of interest to the Human Rights Commission. But there is work which is core to the Human Rights Commission that the departments have to report on. We need to be able to separate that and be able to focus. If we were to remove all the reporting that the departments do and take away the one that is core to the Human Rights Commission, it really wouldn't be that much reporting. And we need to work out a system. Also, the timing of reporting. There is a time when people in the executive are all doing reports. And if the report of the Human Rights Commission was done at about the same time that they are reporting to everybody, they wouldn't feel that just after doing all this reporting to everybody, then they have to start again and do reporting specifically to the Human Rights Commission. I do have sympathy with that kind of, because I'm aware of how many reports they have to make, but I think it's something that we can work around. Key is, what do they have to report on? When do they have to do that report? There's a lot of information when people are preparing their reports, and we could also make sure that our reporting is around the same time. And I think there is a willingness to report, definitely. I don't think that they don't want to report, and I don't think they undermine the Human Rights Commission. I just think that there haven't been ways to work around that, which could be done. And I think the people at the level of commissioners are best placed to devise means of doing that than officials at the level of the secretariat.
Thank you very much. I want to ask you about human rights, but may I just ask one follow-up on what we have just dealt with? I'm familiar with the situation that existed for many of the Chapter 9s, where a lacuna in the PMFA created confusion about who had executive authority. But I would like to be further satisfied that that simple fact created so much tension that you ended up resigning. There was clearly unhappiness at the Human Rights Commission, and such unhappiness can paralyze an institution. I've seen that elsewhere. Now, when you say that the people who resigned were not the people who reported to you, they were in other parts of the commission, does that mean that there was factionalism? Because it can occur, of course, that a CEO builds a group around themselves, and then there are other groups, and you end up with paralysis precisely because you have competing factions. Was there any such thing? And then I would like to get to what to me is the more important matter, and that is human rights. Now, from your CV, you are clearly someone with expertise in and education in economics and in management, and you also have one education degree. But economics and management are clearly your field, and you run things. What I don't see here is either studies or a track record in human rights issues, and so I would think that it is important that we should test your thinking or your approach to these matters, and or your commitment perhaps. So just to use one issue which is current at the moment, what would be your view on the position taken by the new police head and other leading figures on the right of policemen to shoot, to kill? What would be your own view against the statutory background and against the background of judgments given? And what role do you think that the Human Rights Commission could play when an issue like this has resurfaced and is once again contentious?
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Smuts. I don't think there was factionalism. It is correct to say that when there is that level of dissatisfaction, people generally are unhappy. I don't think that I never thought that there were people who were going with a particular faction. And if there was factionalism, surely I think it would have affected that layer that also reported to me. I'm not sure that they would have been left intact like that in a situation. But I think there was dissatisfaction. I myself was not happy because there were lots of decisions that I thought should be taken at the level of the CEO that were not being taken at the level of the CEO. I wouldn't say that there was factionalism. I never noticed that. And then the human rights record. I think the Honorable Smart is correct that maybe what you're actually looking for here is a legal background. I don't have a legal background. But I also depart from the Paris Principles, which talk about how commissions, those institutions must be mixed, those institutions must tap from the other resources, and not just, which would mean that you cannot fill up the Human Rights Commission with lawyers only. You need to have other people. What the country is going through now, the country is battling with service delivery, and service delivery speaks to social and economic rights. And I'd like to think that just from my CV, I should be one of the people that understand social and economic rights very well. And I see the economic and social rights being a make or break. I believe that if we do not have our economic and social rights in place, especially issues around education, issues around health. There is no future for the civil and political rights. So I see them as being very key. And I'm hoping that if I were to be a commissioner, I would want to throw myself in there and see what exactly is stopping us from being able to deliver on those rights. Because in our constitution, those are very important rights. We're one of the very few countries that have those rights as justiciable rights. And I feel it's a challenge. I think it's a challenge that is challenging people in government, that's challenging politicians, that's challenging everybody, because we are doing well at the moment on civil and political rights, considerably much better than other people. But on social and economic rights, they are not going to be the citizens who understand their civil and political rights if there is no improvement there. So I see them actually as being very key. So when you talk about, another member talks about shoot to kill, I know what this sounds like. It sounds like you just go around. And the way that I have understood this is that what the police have said, I don't believe in killing, let me just say that up front. But what I have heard the police say, and I watched earlier this month, the wives, the children in queue laying wreaths for the policemen who have fallen. I see what the police saying is that let's not send the police out there and say that they must go and deal with the criminals who are armed and shooting at them. Let us make sure that the police are also armed and that they can defend themselves. And there are very strict rules that apply to that. They have to show for a start that the police, the person that was confronting them, was somebody who was armed, but not only armed, but ready to attack the policeman. And they must also show that there was no other way that the policeman would have avoided that or defended himself. I think it's not a blank check. What I'm hearing is not a blank check. I think it's something that there has to be a lot of attention paid to. And if there is any case where there has been somebody shot and killed, it needs to be investigated so that people can get to the bottom of it and see under what circumstances it happened. And of course, the proper disciplinary measures have to be taken against the people those who are perpetrators. I think it cannot be in a country like ours be as simple as that, and it should not be.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Okade, I will ask you two general questions around your personality. Now, as a person, what do you consider or regard as your strengths, and by the same token, your weaknesses? The second question around your personality, can you work under pressure? Thank you.
Honorable Dabandaba, I think the strength I have is probably not the strength I was born with, but I think this long experience and the life I've had and the people I've met, worked with, and I see situations, and when you get to some of us, it becomes kind of deja vu. So I see situations and something like that has happened in the past, and I am able to handle it, even if I probably would not have been able to handle it before. But also, one of the strengths I have is that I am one of those people who read. I think it's a strength because I know that not all of us read what you don't know, you read. When I was at the Human Rights Commission, I did. There isn't anything I didn't participate in because, except for conducting legal investigations, because I wasn't a lawyer, but I participated in everything else. It's only the certain group of people who were assigned to actually do investigations and litigations, but everything else I participated. In it, because I read and knew what was going on. And I think for me that has been a strength. Anywhere I get to, I try and understand the situation that I'm in. I probably have a fairly good grasp now of the work that I do here in Parliament and would feel free to answer on any question on it. So I get into that. I read and try and understand the situation, try and understand the people I work with as well. The weaknesses, oh, there are many, but I'm sure you will want me to leave if I go through all of them. But one of the weaknesses is that sometimes I look at things and I don't do them immediately when I could have done them immediately. I sometimes just and then I do work much better under pressure. I tend to shift things and then get into it, which is not a good thing, but it is a weakness. But the other weakness is that of thinking everywhere is my home and trying to. It's something that I need to distance myself from. It's professional to do that. So. There are quite a number of them. I wouldn't want to go through all of them because I disadvantage myself.
Thanks. You mentioned this is a comment not for you to respond, but you mentioned your long life. But I see your CV doesn't have any ID number or any date of birth, so we're left wondering how long your life has been. But anyway, that, as I said, you're not that is just a comment, not for you to respond to. Mine were just a few. The one is, are you applying to be a full-time commissioner or a part-time commissioner? The second one would be, then you spoke about you've had extensive work with the commission. How would you improve the commission? If you could just tell us a bit about that, what areas would you improve on? And the last point is, the Chapter 9s are accountable to the National Assembly. You've worked for the Commission, you're working for Parliament. How would you improve the interaction between the National Assembly and the Human Rights Commission, or how do you feel it should be improved?
Thank you. I'm happy I don't have to answer the first question. Honorable Jeffries has freed me from that. Thank you for the question. On the commission, I think there are a few areas, and those areas have to do with how the commission interacts with the other people. I think there is, for one, as I said earlier, we could do better in the way that the commission interacts with the executive. I think we could find common ground, and I actually don't believe that, maybe because I'm not a lawyer, I don't believe that the subpoenas work. I think there should be a measure of last resort. I think that there needs to be a way that we can find of working with the executive and meeting them and understanding what it is that stops them from cooperating in the way that we would, firstly, just trying to understand whether they actually do understand what they should be, the kind of information that they should be giving to the commission. The many changes in the executive, people change all the time. In fact, in meetings, if there's a meeting, the person who attends the meeting today, most of the time is not the person that's going to attend the second meeting. So understanding the work of the commission and how they need to respond to to the Commission on the information that is required is a challenge, and I'm not sure that it's a challenge that people always put up front, but I think it is a challenge for people. But also, secondly, I think we could also improve on just, I have felt sometimes that maybe the Commission is a bit isolated. And I know that it's all about people are not sure because of the independence of the Commission. But if the Commission is working, if there are serious problems in the hospitals, if there are serious problems in the area of education, even if that resides with the executive, I think there is room for the Commission. Operational independence is not going to be affected by the Commission working with other people. The Commission could work with whoever is involved in these areas that are within the mandate of the Commission, but the Commission guarding its independence. But the Commission, for instance, could give advice to the people, could even tell them what is wrong, because why it's not meeting, why those people are not meeting the requirements. But also, you know, although the Commission is supposed to monitor and assess the human rights, especially the social and economic rights, as far as I know, up until now, there isn't anything that tells you who is being monitored, what the minimum acceptable standard is. So if you're saying to me, I'm not meeting the standard in health, what is the minimum acceptable standard? Nobody has worked on that. Nobody has come up with those. I do know that some time back, the Constitutional Court did say that the Human Rights Commission, in order to monitor and take cases forward, would need to be able to say to the people, this is what is expected as a minimum standard, and when you don't meet this, you're not meeting the minimum standard. So some of those areas are areas that the Commission still needs to work on and do a little more, give it a little more focus. But then also, I would try and improve the relationship with Parliament. And I don't want to say much about that because there's so much that has been said and written about it. Because the Human Rights Commission occupies a very critical, not only the Human Rights Commission, but the Chapter 9 institutions occupy a very strategic position vis-a-vis Parliament. I know that although the executive reports to Parliament, but that kind of information that the Human Rights Commission, for instance, when it comes to progressive realization of the rights, the social and economic rights, subject to availability of resources, but in nobody who ever says what were the resources available, and with the resources that were available, what was achieved and what could have been achieved. So we say subject to availability of resources, but we don't go around and get back to the executive and say, but now you had so much, so why did you only go this far and not that far? So I think there needs to be a little deeper work that is done in that monitoring. I also think that the awareness creation could have been done much better. I still think that there are very many South Africans who don't know much about rights. And even those who think they know about rights, but they misinterpret rights. And this is why people talk about this group as more rights than the others, because I think there hasn't been a deeper understanding and appreciation of how this whole rights field works. So I think that there really is, there are also pieces of legislation that have come up that South Africans are really, I'm exaggerating when I say are not using, but they're not using adequately, they're not using to the extent that they could. The you know, promotion of access to information came out, and there hasn't been any significant move by ordinary South Africans to use that legislation. That legislation being used by very rich people, people who can afford, and people who, when they need to use that legislation, the Human Rights Commission actually has to do research to meet their needs. So, and I don't think that it was meant for them. Similarly with the equality legislation, there hasn't been the kind of usage of that legislation. I know that some of the regulations have not been promulgated yet, like 2 out of 3. But even then, some of these issues are already in our constitution, so people could be using this legislation, but it is not used to that extent. There are all sorts of problems, and I think that a lot of it lies with information. I don't think there's enough information out there. But also, the whole rural sector of our country is not using the Human Rights Commission. They are definitely not, and those are the people who should use it more than anybody else. Because if the Human Rights Commission was established not for the rich who can afford lawyers and long periods of litigation, if it was established for the poor, then the people who are using it now are not the poor. There are quite a number of areas that we could work on. If I were given the opportunity, I don't think it would be possible for me to do it with the work that I do now and do justice. So I would prefer to be full-time.
Thank you, Chairperson. Exactly your last comments about the reach of the laws that are intended to benefit the vulnerable and poor have covered what I wanted to say, but still, I would like to know as to what it is that you would want the Commission to do, you would get the Commission to do in order to ensure that the benefits of these legislation, pieces of legislation get to the intended beneficiaries. And secondly, Chairperson, the Human Rights Commission is required to promote human rights in a context where in a number of occasions arise conflict between cultural rights as well as the rights relating to equality and other things. For instance, you would have been exposed to instances where the Commission had to get involved in problems arising from cultural practices like circumcision of boys and virginity inspection and other related things like recently Ugutwala. How have you, or how do you intend to strike the necessary balance as you seek to use the Commission to ensure that people get the rights that are due to them, while at the same time not losing the essence that informs the practices that may appear on the surface to be a violation of human rights? I don't know if I'm coming across clearly in trying to put my question. And also, as you said, this commission has to assist the poor, and especially those who are in rural areas. They speak mostly African languages, indigenous languages. But what languages are you able to communicate with?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I'm going to start with the cultural practices. I know that in some of the cultural practices, there is an argument that the end justifies the means. I've heard people relate talking about
the practice of Chwala and saying there are many very stable marriages that started in that way, and that is very problematic. I'm sure the honourable member knows, because it takes away the choice in an individual. But I think what would be very important, even with the with circumcision, I think that if there is there's a cultural right that says there must be circumcision, I think the commission would only quarrel with the people. We see so many kids dying. So many kids are dying. So many kids are being taken away from their parents without them even knowing. I don't think that there is sufficient monitoring in that area. There isn't sufficient monitoring even by the rural folk themselves who are supposed to be monitoring this. People keep saying, it was never done that way. This is like just not doing it right. But people are dying, and there isn't anything that they are doing. So I think that the Human Rights Commission has to get in, without saying people must stop the cultural practice, but they have to get in to ensure that people don't die from this cultural practice, because Human Rights Commission has to protect the right to life. So there isn't a problem until such time that people have to die. And this for instance, this virginity testing, is that what it's called? I'm sorry, honorable member. Inspection. Yes. Okay. All right. It's there are health issues involved in it, and those have been pointed out many times, and this issue of the dignity, which cuts across all the rights. So these things, I'm sure, the practices, I'm sure, were not done in that way in the good old days, but things have changed, and the cultural practices also have to make sure that if the people that used to do these things are no longer available, these things, they monitor how these things are done and protect life. The honourable member asked about how to reach the rural folk. I speak about almost five languages. So if even my name and my surname belong to two different groups already, so just add a few more. So I speak about five. So but I think I take the point that the honourable member is making, because the accessibility of the Human Rights Commission is not just about physical accessibility. It's also about communication. It's very important that the Human Rights Commission is able to reach the people. For a start, I don't think that it's too much to say that the Human Rights Commission should be able to work with the people in the areas where they operate, where they will be able to speak the languages. Even amongst the people at the Human Rights Commission themselves, they should be able to speak. They should be able to communicate. There should be a mixture of people who are able to communicate in some of these languages. I know that there are definitely areas that are very problematic in the Human Rights Commission, where there is no one that can communicate in the language of the people where they operate. At commissioner level, at secretariat level, and I think that if these are the people that we are meant to be serving, we need to be able to communicate in the languages. We have to find a way of communicating in the languages.
Well, thank you. I'm sure that will be all. We have exhausted our time. Dr. Mrasim?
We're all going to give a shot at it, so I didn't raise my hand. Okay, I will try to be fast. But first of all, Mrs. McCart and I mean, you have a very impressive resume. You come across very impressively. and everything but respect. Nonetheless, in this type of process, one is to test elements of weakness and point a finger on that which one doesn't like. So accept what I'm saying from the background. And I do accept that one can come to a human right culture, a human right expertise from different paths. The law is not the only one. Social science, political science are also others. But there must be a human right culture. And shaped as one is in the human right culture, one is aware that the infringer of human rights, most generally, is the government. Private sector can only infringe human rights up to a very minimum sector. So the Human Rights Commission must be embedded with an attitude to fight government or to put an halt on government, or keep government within check and balances. You were the CEO during the formative stages of the Human Rights Commission. And from my viewpoint, the Human Rights Commission has been, and I say this because I would like you to correct me with concrete examples to fill in my ignorance, but my perception of the Human Rights Commission has been that of a lame institution. There have been human rights fights in this country about HIV/AIDS, about homosexual relationship, about a number of cases, refugee affairs, but they took place in the courtrooms, and the Human Rights Commission played a second fidget, a secondary role. There have been organizations out there, lawyers for human rights, which have outperformed the Human Rights Commission. And when I hear you speaking today with, I mean, what the Honorable Matt said to a human rights lawyer, it's abhorrent. I mean, the chief of police talking about shoot to kill, it's abhorrent not because of the technicalities, but because of the message it sends out. When the president talked about having children pledging allegiance to the country, that's abhorrent. There have been a number of abhorrent situations to anyone training in human rights which have not triggered a response by the commission. So I want to be correct, and I really want to know, what has the commission done in practical terms during those 7 years, and how can that unsatisfactory track record be corrected if my perception is correct?
Thank you, Honorable Anderson. The Honorable Member already knows that our Constitution and all the other relevant pieces of legislation that we have operate horizontally and vertically. And the Human Rights Commission doesn't fight government. The Human Rights Commission will disagree with government as and when government commits human rights violations, and the Human Rights Commission will be expected to take its place. And there are many ways that the Human Rights Commission are available to the Human Rights Commission. Section 6 of the Human Rights Act allows the Human Rights Commission to seek an audience with government. So when the Human Rights Commission is not on the streets, it's not always because the Human Rights Commission is not talking to government on those issues. I know that on the AIDS issue, the Human Rights Commission had a lot of meetings with, I wasn't a commissioner, I wasn't operating at that level, but the Human Rights Commission did have a number of meetings with the Minister of Health. And the Human Rights Commission also had meetings with the AIDS organization, I forget the name, but, the Treatment Action Campaign did have meetings with the Treatment Action Campaign, and at some point the Human Rights Commission had a meeting with all the actors, and my understanding is that they had never met like that before. I think the Human Rights Commission has at times seemed very isolated. I think there is more that the Human Rights Commission could do, definitely. I do believe that. But I think sometimes when the Human Rights Commission is not in the newspapers, people don't know that it is actually meeting those people in terms of the avenues that are available to it. The Human Rights Commission has done, I wouldn't know where to start, but the Human Rights Commission has done quite a number of, the Human Rights Commission has been involved with refugees. The Human Rights Commission has been involved with the child-headed households. The Human Rights Commission has been involved with, you know, just there's a lot. You are correct when you say, I remember correct when you say I was there at the formative stages when the Human Rights Commission was actually just setting itself up and making sure that it is available in the different parts of the country and making sure that it is accessible. But also the Human Rights Commission was participating when there was that very hectic period which was looking at the legislation in the country and making sure that that legislation was compliant with our own constitution. The Human Rights Commission was participating in all that. So I think there's quite a lot, and I'm not sure that there's enough time to actually go through everything that the Human Rights Commission has done. But I think the Human Rights Commission has done quite remarkable work. And as time changes, the challenges are going to be different, and the Human Rights Commission should be ready to move and be able to take on the challenges of that time.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Tadde. We'll let you go. Thank you for coming. Before we get the next candidate, there is somebody who has not shortlisted that in his wisdom, Bonan decided to invite to come. And I take very strong exception to that, I must say, because if officials change our dimension, we can run into a crisis. So I will certainly reprimand him about that. I think because the person is here already, maybe we should just interview the person. Yeah, that's what he says, Inspector. It's a very, it's a fundamental mistake. It is quite fundamental. That sort of mistake. It's Andilen Mukitama. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Let's take another candidate, Bonan. I think we tried to stay within 45 minutes. It wasn't bad. Almost. Oh, I see. So, please, let's come in. Take a seat yourself. That's Mr. Titus. Take a seat there, sir. My name is Ngwakura Matodi. I'm chairman of this committee. The commissioners will take, not commissioners, members, honorable members will introduce themselves to their good self. Then at the end, we'll invite you to introduce yourself and also just tell us some few things about yourself, your work experience. We're interested in your familiarity with human rights. And explain to us why you would want to be considered for the position of commissioner. Also look at briefly, what impact would you as an individual make on the commission if you had to be appointed? Thank you very much. Dr. President, thank you.
I guess I'm the only one who needs to be introduce himself because I'm the only one without a name tag. It's Mario Ambrosini. The other names are there.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good afternoon to the panel members. You have my CV, and you probably saw what I have been exposed to. If I have to speak about my experience of human rights, I can start off with my first employment as a public prosecutor in the Department of Justice, understanding the workings of the criminal justice system, where we were required, myself required, to be involved in common law crimes, prosecution, drunken driving and those kind of matters. I was not required to be involved in political matters. That was a request that we put as students at the University of the Western Cape when we obtained the bursaries, because the bursaries at the time was in the same way as the bursaries to still students studying or involved in education, becoming teachers, to work one extra year longer for the department than they obtained the bursary. And in the same way, around 79, we were given that position. When it came to the end of our studies, that was our discussion with the department, in particular Advocate Kutzer at the time was the Director General of the department, through Professor Richard van der Ross, who was the Rector of the University. from there I was given an opportunity to go to the Netherlands to spend 6 years of my life there to do research and to study, and I managed to obtain a master's degree in international human rights, constitutional rights, international relations as some of my major subjects. I also was in a position to complete my doctorate at the University of Leiden, and while I was finishing off with my doctorate in 1993, I had the opportunity to attend very intense diplomatic training at the Institute of International Relations, Klingendaal, with about 33 hopeful ANC diplomats. At the time, extremely intensive course of about 3 months, 3-4 months, in order to come back to South Africa and assist with the Department of Justice, Department of Foreign Affairs, in terms of our diplomatic training at the time. That did not materialize when we came back because of sunset clauses and those kind of issues at the time. However, I've maintained relationships with the Department of Foreign Affairs in terms of training that I was required to conduct in terms of human rights and foreign policy, particularly to young diplomats as well, in the period 1993-1998, and then it stopped, and in the 2000s I was requested to come back and conduct those training, practical training to young diplomats in terms of particularly the international system of human rights, which was the focus of my doctorate, and also my experience as I came back into the country in terms of the Gonsal Commission, where I was required to work. When I came back, I first worked for the South African Law Commission as a senior researcher, and about 14 days after that, Judge Goldstone approached me because he needed someone to assist him with his commission, because his legislation provided the commission with the possibility of establishing an institute, research or otherwise, into public violence and political violence at the time. And I was fortunate to be involved in the Human Rights Institute of South Africa, which is still in existence, initially funded by the Norwegians, and bringing some kind of technology into the issue of political violence so that we can, or could at the time, which sounds very strange, it was really a breakthrough at the time, to be able to search in free text as we have internet now. It was a few years before the internet. But we could, for example, punch in the name Eugene de Kock, and all the evidence around de Kock would come to the fore, and that really assisted the investigators in a major way, amongst others, to get a coordinated group on the immense volume of evidence that was before the Cultural Commission. So as I said, from there we moved into the Human Rights Institute, stayed there for about 2 years, and then moved to the Technikon Southern Africa, where I became involved in the police practice program, where they had a massive program of about 25,000 to 40,000 students per annum. Through the advantages of distance education, we could deliver that particular product to the police, and I was required in particular to focus upon human rights and policing and to bring that into the discussion, and that was a really rewarding experience. from there, the University of South Africa merged with the Technikon South Africa, and thank you. And I became the deputy dean of the law faculty, or as we call it at UNISA, the law college. I was dean of the faculty at the Technikon SA in what we call public safety and criminal justice faculty, where we looked at the police practice program, quite an extensive one, correctional services, private security industry, and we also had an institute for human rights and criminal justice studies that fell under me as dean of that faculty. Then UNISA merged with the Technikon SA, and as I said, I became the deputy executive dean, as you'll see in my CV, because the deanship was then under the existing dean, Professor Rita Maria. From there, I was seconded to the Ministry of Justice to get the Justice Training College for about 5 months, which was extremely rewarding, to bring back my experience in the as a prosecutor and in the criminal justice system in general. It was just amazing to see the management experience that I have gained up till now and had to apply it. I just thought it was part of me, but all of a sudden I was in a new environment. I had to effect managerial interventions, etc. And it was just amazing to see the small kind of interventions that you made and what impact it had on interpreters, on prosecutors, on magistrates' training. And that was quite rewarding. In the process, I felt I need to move away from academic life and I want to explore something else. I unfortunately could not stay on with the Department of Justice because it was the incumbent was at the time suspended due to disciplinary investigations, and it would not have been easy, even if I got a contract position, which the DG suggested I take. It was still, the incumbent was still due to come back should the disciplinary hearing fall in her favor, so I was not prepared to take that kind of risk. She was eventually moved out of the department and the post became available. I then got the opportunity to move into the Afrikaans language and cultural organization, the ATKAFIA, which really swung my life completely in a different direction, into culture, into language, into Afrikaans culture and language, into diversity, language diversity, and to move across cultures. And that became quite an enjoyable challenge, and that's where I am at the moment. So in terms of my experience up till now with the Human Rights Commission, I've really engaged with them quite extensively over since their inception, and could make contributions where I was required, amongst others, to open a conference on the third decade on racism, which Dr. Pichana requested me to do. I wrote a brief paper on foreign policy and human rights for South Africa, which they felt was a bit over the top for South Africa.
I think our time for
introduction
is almost over. Let's follow the order that we used earlier on. Let's start with Honorable Salton. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Titus, and welcome to the panel.
Thank you.
According to the outgoing chairperson of the commission, Mr. Jody Colopin, the effectiveness of the commission depends in a large measure on the nature of the support and cooperation it enjoys from the executive and from parliament. And in this regard, he says, there remains considerable room for improvement, including that of the responsiveness of the executive. How would you improve that relationship with the executive? In particular, when the commission appeared before us, there was a tardiness from the departments to respond to complaints, resulting in subpoenas, and your relationship with Parliament as well. How would you improve those two relationships? And secondly, how do you see the relationships between the Human Rights Commission and other Chapter 9 organizations? If you've read the Ad Hoc Committee's report, the CAD ASMA report, there is a view that there should be an amalgamation of all commissions, certain Chapter 9 institutions into one single commission. What would your view be on that issue? And I see that you are a member of the Human Rights Institute of South Africa. Can you give us a bit more detail as to what that involves? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Swart. Perhaps the last question first. I'm the chairperson of the board of the Human Rights Institute of South Africa, a position that was vacated by Mrs. Sheena Duncan and before that Judge Goldstone. But unfortunately, I don't have much time to really play my role there, and I've asked somebody else to deputize for me in there. But that is basically at that level. I used to be the executive director of that institute. As far as your other questions are concerned, Mr. Swart, it is not about the independence of the commission. It is really about understanding the mandate of the commission, the constitutional mandate, the legislative framework of the commission around its independence. And the executive needs to understand that very clearly. It's also in their benefit to have such institutions, same with Parliament, and to see the three institutions really as an opportunity to give effect to the constitutional mandates, the fundamental rights and freedoms in the Constitution, and to really to make it work. Because if you look at our country today, it strikes me that we have turned our back on our constitution in such a way in a question of 15 years. And we really need to understand how we need and how it's in all of our interest to bring that constitution back to its former, I won't say glory, but respect that it really commanded. At the moment, our rights, in my view, our paper rights, they are more violated than respected and promoted. And there is a serious intervention needed to bring us back to the values of that constitution. And the word, in terms of your questions, to me is independence. That we must understand that the executive violates human rights more than it respects them. That Parliament has a particular oversight role and also a guiding role as far as human rights are concerned. And the Human Rights Commission has its almost operational functions that it needs to bring to the fore. And I would really argue for understanding the value of independence, understanding the value of independent thought, that it is really there. If you look at international practice, it is something that should be a cornerstone of our constitution. So yes, I think there is a role for each and every one of us, but we must understand our roles and we must really understand human rights, understand freedom of expression and what it means to have a diversity of opinion, and how within the diversity of opinion we can pull things together. And it is not a question whether politicians should feel threatened. I think they should really feel that this is also enlarging their own mandate to have independent thought, and particularly from a Chapter 9 institution. As to the Asmar report, I think the report has a lot of merit and it brought out very, very interesting conclusions. The question is just why is it accepted? Why is it still on the shelves? Maybe, perhaps, because it may sound too easy to have those kinds of solutions as one commission. Maybe because we will bring back a kind of bureaucracy that we will not be able to deal with if we have such a massive element. Maybe, perhaps, because if you really decentralize the issues that we have at the moment, the gender commission, we need a specific focus on gender. The international experience is very clear. While we had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, clearly outlining the equality principle, clearly outlining the rights of women, it was still necessary to bring the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women as a particular focus with its own structures. I think one commission that did not come out very strongly is the CRL Commission. And I am interacting with them over the years quite seriously. I think they should also be given the opportunity to blossom and to come to their bloom, if I may use those words, because they certainly have a massive role to play in terms of culture, which is worldwide such a massive issue that we need to understand. And in our country as well, the conflict between traditional culture and human rights, the old debate of universality as opposed to cultural relativism, how universal are human rights and where do you need to bring in practices of cultural practice, religious practice, and that kind of balance. And we're not really engaging with this at the level, I think, as we should. I think the Commission, the Human Rights Commission, obviously needs to work a little bit more with the CRL Commission. Hopefully the CRL Commission will stop fighting among themselves, as they've done over the past couple of years, and really understand the value of what they are really, what their mandate is. I mean, just to do an audit on all cultures in the country, and all religions, and all linguistics, that in itself will be such a simple audit, but such value.
I'm handling here. So I've got to be very strict with my time.
Thank you. Doctor, there's water has been put down for Dr. Titus, but it's a little bit far away. Please.
Thank you.
Sir, I take certain things as read, your qualifications, your fitness and propriety, your degrees from Leiden in particular, the doctorates in human rights law, the LLMs, and so forth, your work for the South African Law Commission, the Goldstone Commission, and also it seems to me from your CV that you have demonstrated leadership abilities, having acted as a dean and so forth. So I would like the pleasure, if you don't mind, of hearing you on three human rights issues. Firstly, crime. You literally wrote the book on policing and human rights. You've written several chapters in two of the handbooks. You've been invited by everyone from the Chief of New Scotland Yard to our own Human Rights Commission to address the NOSCAT on crime and policing. Would you give us your views on the issue that has now resurfaced again, the matter of police and shooting to kill, policemen being able to shoot to kill, notwithstanding the provisions of the relevant statute and the relevant judgment. So would you give us a view on that, please, and what would be the wise way to lead on this issue? The second one, on race, you were invited at the time of the drafting of the Equality Act to address the grouping that was doing the drafting on the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. Therefore, you have a background in equality and race. Would you like to give us your impression of the current debate around race? Yet again, something that is resurfacing. Is there a real debate? Isn't there? And lastly, the matter of Caster Semenya. If you would deal with that against the background of the right to information and privacy, perhaps. Should there be provision for genetic privacy? What sort of a role would the Human Rights Commission, if you were there, play on any of these matters?
Thank you very much. I'll start with the first one. Policing shooting to kill. My sense is that there is the current Section 49 really provides already for a shoot to kill policy under the particular circumstances. My sense, and I have not spent enough attention to the current proposals, but I get the sense from the media that is a bit over the top. It seems that we need to look at the overall package of policing. Because it is quite concerning and concerning that the Metro Police really do not understand their function. The Metro Police is a major concern to me, the way that they execute their duties, and the way they manhandle people, that they really need to be roped in very seriously. It's a question of training. And I think that the South African police has the wherewithal to assist them. I think the South African police, in my view, in terms of my interactions with them in the early 90s throughout the whole transitionary period, how they really come from a tradition of being in the firing line consistently in terms of defending the apartheid order. But when they made the switch, they really made a substantial switch. because they come from that particular background, and the issues of human rights, of community policing, is something that they really took to heart because they came from a particular order that they wanted to turn their backs to. I'm generalizing, obviously, but in terms of the commitment that I've seen up till now within the South African police, I would like to see that there is a stronger interaction with them and the Metro Police. And I'm more or less talking about the Metro Police in Johannesburg, where I have more understanding of. I don't always understand this country called the Western Cape. but so what I'm saying is, yes, with in terms of the shoot to kill, I think, and this has been debated substantially in terms of what is the provisions made for within defense, within defending life, limb, and property of yourself and other people, that there is no exclusion in terms of shooting to kill. But of course, there's always the question of parameters, of boundaries, and what informed that particular police official's decision making at the time. So it's also a case by case basis that need to be considered. I think we have missed the immense drive on policing and human rights. I think it certainly came, in my view, since the Minister of Police, Chief Chweke, started to take authority, that he really, in terms of the balance, because it's always a balance, and the police always being in the firing line of being soft on crime, of not coming to the fore, and we needed to have strong signals coming from top management. And also that there was a study by the Human Sciences Research Council saying South Africans are more safe now under Steve Twitty. So it is not a yay or nay, it is really quite a balance that we need to take into consideration, and I would like to see that balance in the current under the current ministry. And I think the Human Rights Commission should have an opportunity to interact continuously with the executive on this, and obviously with Parliament. So what I'm saying is, this is a balancing act, and I always say that no one in the country is finding themselves or find themselves at that level that the police are. On the one hand, being given the authority by the Constitution to infringe on people's rights, and on the other hand, to respect and promote those rights. Not an advocate, not a journalist, not Parliament, not anybody. That police official has that kind of balancing act, and I think one needs to show a kind of understanding for that. I don't want to give the impression that I condemn the Metro Police, but I think they should be subjected to serious evaluation, monitoring, and training. The second question regarding race, in terms of the current debate on race, I think we should have a debate on race. I think we should realize that we are in a new South Africa for the past 15 plus years, and we cannot look at race through the same lenses as we had in 1976, in the 80s, even in 1994. South Africa is dynamic, it's changing, and we need to be in a position to put the issue of race on the table. And then, I think, is when we come to the point of understanding and accepting the diversity of cultures, diversity of races in South Africa, a language we would never have spoken in the apartheid days, because that would have played into the hands of the government at the time, who wanted and who did use those arguments to separate. I think now we should be able to look each other in the eye and speak about race, because everybody is jumping on the bandwagon that this is racist and that is racist. We need to come and understand as a country what we understand by racism. What is it? In my view, it is a question of violation of human dignity and human rights. If we have that kind of understanding on racism, then I think we can start talking. But it's, to me, very difficult to see now that right-wing organizations, and they all have a place under the Constitution, use race as an excuse. And I think the Human Rights Commission will be the ideal platform to clarify those matters, and not to speak through particular language anymore, but to realize that we are in a situation now where we can evaluate, we can look back, to the development of a democracy. We had our faults, we have our made our mistakes, but now we can really make use of that to take that forward. So what I'm saying is, even with the Equality Act that you referred to, sometimes I don't know what those magistrates are doing there where they sit. Sometimes in terms of the criminal justice system, my sense is these are people on their way out or who really have no understanding of human rights sometimes. And that even they should open themselves to training. You know, magistrates and judges don't want to be called to training. They say, bring me to a colloquium or to a seminar or something, but don't say you train me, because no one can train me. But I think there we need a commission that can evaluate the cases that came before them, look at the thing now in terms of a strong evaluatory approach and consequently and seriously engage with the Magistrates Commission, with the new Judicial Service Institute, I think it is called, because whatever you may say about Judge Floppy started the issue around race and gender discrimination in the Cape High Court. And as a result of that, Mr. Justice Langa, Chief Justice Langa said, but we're open to that. And they have a massive intervention through the highly reputable company Mandate Mulefi, and I don't work with them, so I don't need to. I work with them at other places, but I really think the way they've engaged magistrates and judges around sensitivity on gender, sensitivity on race, is a result of Mr. Justice Floppy that we don't always recognize. And they all obviously keep these things under wraps sometimes because of the sensitivity of matters, but I think we need to understand the underlying fact that was recognized by the Constitutional Court, that judges are quite prepared to be trained, if we may use that word, or exposed to sensitivity training. And I would like to see the results of that at some stage.
I'd like us to go to the next question. We are running behind you now.
Thank you, sir. May I go for the next question?
No, it's Semenya.
For the Semenya White matter. Again, I think it's a balanced approach that we need to follow here, but it seems to me that the facts are rolling out every day. New facts are coming to the fore, etc. But I think the underlying principle is that we must respect people's privacy, that we should have respected Caster Semenya's privacy much more. If I may stop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Three short questions, Dr. Titus. The first one is, tell the panel, please, about your strengths and weaknesses as a person. The second question is, do you consider yourself well-equipped to handle human rights connected with African traditional law and customs? The last question, you have told the panel about your involvement in criminal justice at UNISA. Did that also include criminology and penology, and how will this help you in the Human Rights Commission? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I was trying to say a lot, and then I don't need to say everything. Professor, thank you very much for those questions. Yes, I had criminology and penology as part of the department reporting to me, and that certainly has a lot to do. Sometimes I think we may sometimes live in a strange world of theories and etc., whereas the practical experience that staff members brought from the Technicon side provided a very interesting balance and complementing the knowledge. We learned to understand the issue of the tyranny of disciplines. Because of my discipline, I say this, and because of me being a sociologist, I say this. Whereas the challenge the past few years is one of transdisciplinarity to utilize all these disciplines, criminology, penology, law, because law professors can also be quite snotty. But really to understand the deficiencies in law training, that we really can learn a massive lot in terms of criminology. We saw it, for example, in the research.
the criminologists had more the focused interviews, the questionnaires, the trends and analysis. The lawyers only looked at the court precedents, etc. That's why they have much more public more publications than anybody else. But yes, that certainly can help. Your question on African traditional law is one that I think needs to find its place in human rights. But in the international discourse, in terms of, again, how universal are human rights and how should we accommodate African traditional law as well, in the same way as we deal with Muslim traditional law, in the same way as we deal with the Jamaican experience, the Indian experiences, etc. That this is a debate that has been ongoing. There was a whole conference in 1993 called by the United Nations on this matter. I think we need to bring that into South Africa. We had the experience or the newspaper references to Ukutwala, which I think left the table too quickly. I think we need to perhaps bring it back so that we can break open the Western kind of approach to the traditional African, and not necessarily that, but where do we connect? Where do we find, there's an author called Jack Donnelly, he speaks about weak cultural relativism, because it's always presented as the one or the other. But this shows the dynamism of human rights. We need also to highlight the areas within African traditional law that really are violations of human rights, as people brought it around the Ukutwala matter. And the Human Rights Commission, I think, has dealt with this in a way. But they also had the experience of, what's the man's name now? Khosi Tladi, I think, from Northwest, who sentenced a woman to 6 months to sit in stay in her house because she did not want to accept the practice that she needed because her husband died, to throw herbs behind her as she walked to the gate. And that would have been very interesting had the matter come before court. It was settled. But I think we're scratching the surface still on that. Your other point on my strengths and weaknesses, may be a long answer, but I'll try and make it short. I think I have an understanding in terms of human rights. I think I have leadership. I understand also the management of human rights, because we can have all these ideas if you don't have the understanding and the experience of management, managing the processes. And here the Commission is really well established, particularly under Colopin and Chipumiani, to bring that kind of very sound kind of management into the, and I hope it will not be lost. I remember under Pichana, Max Coleman resigned, and Helen Suzman resigned, and Rutia resigned, and Rhoda Kadali resigned because they just couldn't live with the kind of management style. So the issue of management and human rights management in particular is quite relevant. Weaknesses, I sometimes take on too much and don't always follow through. I really have to rely on my secretary for quite a lot, because I can say a lot of things, but I don't always take time to implement them to the full. But I have good secretaries, and they really help.
Maybe just on that point, taking on too much, you're being nominated as a part-time commissioner. Are you going to manage? You are you're working for the Atia Kabir. You're also chair of Transparency International, the South African section, chair of the Board of Trustees of the Human Rights Commission, Board of Art Club, and so on. Secondly, if you do think you can manage and you're going to remain on all those bodies, will there be any conflicts of interest between what some of those bodies stand for? And then I think linked to that, I mean, the Bean complaints, I'm not sure what the Atia Kabir's position was regarding the position of Afrikaans in the new South Africa. I would have imagined that Atia Kabir would have had a position on that. What's your position on the position of Afrikaans And then lastly, I don't see it on your CV, but the Brain Belange Initiative. I understand you're the leader of that. What does that stand for? Is that on the issue of coloured people's rights and whether they are being undermined in the new South Africa, which has come up from a number of quarters? What's your view on whether that is accurate or not? And would there be a conflict of interest if you remained as leader of that initiative? Why didn't you also put it on your CV? Thanks.
Yes, I'm sorry, that was an oversight. I was here at the interview last week on the ACBC board because I'm also on the shortlist there. And the chairperson asked the same question, but that was really an oversight. If I can start with that, this is a question, again, as I mentioned, that we are in a new South Africa. We do not need to think that we're going to go back, take people back to apartheid. But in terms of coloured people experiencing marginalisation from the new South Africa, this is where this issue has been born, to show to people that they do not need to be marginalised, that their rights will be recognised. And it's also a question of equality, that we seem to have equality for a number of groups, but when it comes to the coloured people, there's still the sense of we are not being served at that equality level. And it's a question of engaging them with people and to show them that they belong in the mainstream of South Africa, that they have a right of existence, not as in the past when they called themselves so-called coloureds or black, that they need to realise that there's nothing wrong to be shameful about being called coloured, and also to have a pride and recognition of where they're coming from, who their parents were, what their history is. And in a word, we're beginning to realise that there are a lot of white coloureds in South Africa, and a lot of African coloureds, and a lot of Indian coloureds, and a lot of coloured coloureds. So we feel the need to say that we are not having neighbourly relations with each other, or we have cultural relations that we share. We are family. We are blood family. And we need to recognise that, whether it is with the Blanches, the Jeffreys, the Holomisas, whoever, that we realise that in terms of the development of this country's history, it is a history of miscegenation, of mixed heritage. And we can and should be proud of that. And it's not a question of taking people back or something that you should be ashamed of, but it's really something to be proud of. And therefore, we felt we need to take on the immense socioeconomic challenges that exist in that community, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, etc., and to recognize people in that community that are really doing a lot of good work. And we're not exclusive. We cannot be exclusive. We must be inclusive, as I say, in terms of the family relations that we're all shoved under the carpet, and we want to bring it out now. And also then in terms of the human rights, to show people that they are also entitled to all the rights in the Constitution, along with the fruits of this country. The position on Afrikaans, the Article 10 position on Afrikaans is that it is an inclusive vision, that there are many more people than the white people speaking Afrikaans, and Afrikaans is not a white language.
What I really want to know, do you think Afrikaans is marginalised? Do you think coloured people are marginalised? Not what the organisation stands for. What's your view?
My view on Afrikaans is it is not a marginalised language, that we have a continual debate around the higher functions of Afrikaans in terms of universities, etc. But there is a large number of people, 9% of the population, coloured people, and also a lot of poor white people and African people who speak Afrikaans, and that we would like to be a home to everybody. That the language had advantages in the past, and we want to use those advantages for other languages as well, in light of the issue of diversity of cultures within the Constitution, within the Freedom Charter of South Africa belongs to all who live in it. So in that kind of sense, it is certainly moving away. My own view is that. That's why I started working there. And when I engage with people, they are quite comfortable with that. And that includes literature, it includes drama, it includes poetry that we're beginning to recognize from all sides. We've met with the ANC and the TA House on this matter, and the view there was also
that we should utilize this organization in an inclusive way to benefit all of its speakers, but also other people that can benefit from that. My position on the other boards...
Do you think colored people are being marginalized in the new South Africa?
I think they are marginalized in certain positions in terms of the application of the Employment Equity Act, when people are vying for particular positions, that there is sometimes a sense of preferential treatment to African candidates. And we need to and would like to highlight that and to bring that to the particular bodies on that. But on the other hand, Steve Baker also told us that the most powerful ally in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. And we would like, in terms of the mind of colored people, also to indicate to them that there's a lot of personal choice, personal responsibility that should bring them back into universities, make use of educational facilities, etc. So there is a responsibility that you have as an individual also to pull yourself up on your own bootstraps. Some of the things, other things are systemic as well, but within this kind of mixed circumstances, we would like to say to colored people that they are part, that no one can draw a line through their existence, and that they have a role in this country. Just briefly, in terms of the organization that you mentioned, I am stepping down from Transparency International and the Human Rights Institute and all these other bodies that really saps energy, and I think they are very competent people that can take over. But your question is still a relevant one. We will be able to manage. That's my decision.
Mr. Chairman, I'm both satisfied as well as covered. Thank you.
It's okay. Mr. Titus, just a few questions. You say the executive and even parliament need to appreciate the independence of the commission. Do you by that mean that there tends to be some kind of interference in the independence of the commission by the executive or parliament? And also, in the same way, you say the executive tends to violate more the rights of the people than expected. Do you mind giving some examples of that kind of violation? On the question of the reach of the commission to the intended beneficiaries, particularly people living in the rural areas, what do you believe needs to be done by the commission to ensure that its work is known by the intended beneficiaries so that they take advantage of it? And lastly, on the matter of, you did mention that these commissions tended to not to want to work together. What do you suggest needs to be done to ensure that there's cooperation and coordination of the activities of these bodies? Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. The issue of the commissions not wanting to work together, I don't think I put it as strongly as that. But I would like to say that there is a case to be made to work closer together. The CIR Commission, for example, does not interact as they should with the Human Rights Commission. The Gender Commission can do much more. And sometimes the Human Rights Commission gets all those kinds of issues. And one will have to develop a system whereby they can be involved in particular referrals. I'm part of a committee on minorities report that South Africa actually submitted to the United Nations. And the experience there is that even government departments do not turn up for meetings or submit reports and really make life very difficult for to the Foreign Affairs Department in order to present South Africa internationally. Just jumping quickly in terms of your issue on the executive. The executive, in terms of service delivery, is clearly in the violation of so many rights. In terms of municipalities not functioning, in terms of the corruption that we experience from the highest level that are not investigated properly. And there is a clear move at the moment to align corruption as a violation of human rights. then I think we won't have too much difficulty in bringing that into South Africa. So when it comes to those kind of matters, it's really a question of violating the police in particular, as I referred to, need to be brought in line. Because that kind of brutality that we are seeing, that the Independent Complaints Directorate have reported upon on so many occasions here in Parliament, is clearly a violation of those kind of rights. So this is an international experience, that, and that is why we cannot have human rights in the hands of government. Government is not capable of promoting, respecting human rights. That's why we need Chapter 9 institutions, and that's why the operative word with the Chapter 9 institutions is independence. I cannot recall anything immediately in terms of meddling, but I don't know why these interviews were postponed by the executive. At the moment, I think the current commissioner will have to run the commission alone. The others are all resigning this month. Again, I cannot say that's political meddling, and I would like to come back to you on that at another occasion. But in a word, government is not known all across the world for promoting, respecting human rights. Just see if I missed something else. The regional Human Rights Commission in rural areas, I think they've made quite a lot of strides in terms of moving into rural areas. They can do much more, but this term of the commission, this one, was more known for its reach into rural areas with its infrastructure throughout the country, its regional offices. Again, as I say, much more can be done. But I always say, when we ask these kinds of questions, that we need to understand also, or just refer to the Independent Complaints Direct, no, to the IEC, how it reached to all South Africans in terms of the right to vote. But the right to vote is still termed a classical human right, a liberal human right, a Western right, but it was made available and people were given access in terms of that. Coupled with that is obviously the indivisibility of human rights, and where the issues of service delivery in terms of socioeconomic and cultural rights need to be given effect. And this is where we stumble when it comes to service delivery, that service delivery is a violation of human rights.
This point about the interviews being postponed by the executive, I think that should just be clarified, that I don't know what you're talking about. With respect, the previous parliament advertised for the positions. I think the election and the change in the parliament had an effect. But as far as I'm aware, and I think the other members of the committee would agree, the executive has had nothing to do with the scheduling of these interviews.
I tend to be corrected, sir.
Thank you very much, Doctor, and we thank you for taking your time from your busy schedule to come and be with us here. Yeah?
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we should tell them to answer within X minutes.
Welcome. My name is Ngwakura Matlodi, chairperson of the committee. And the members will introduce themselves following the order. We want you to brief us
about your experience, specifically in relation to human rights, and concern. Why do you think you should be considered for the position of Commissioner, Human Rights? What impact do you have as an individual on the Commission in the event you are appointed? Let's start with Dr. Abdul Sinema. Honorable. No, he's not going to speak. They're going to, introducing yourselves. Yeah.
Mario Ambrosini, I introduced myself outside.
The rest, the names are over there. You can see them. Well, with you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I must start by thanking the committee for having shortlisted me and also for inviting me for this very important event. As far as my experience is concerned, Chairperson, I do hold a Bachelor of Science in Biology and Chemistry and an LLB, and then a Master's degree in Constitutional Litigation. I was actually checking how long have I been working. It's approximately 20 years, because I finished my LLB in 1989. Then I worked as a Register of Patents and Trademarks in Lesotho. Then I worked at the University of Natal for about 4 years as a Center for Criminal Justice, doing research, trying to link up human political violence as well as the role of government there. And then I left and I came down to Cape Town, where I taught law at the University of Western Cape in public law and constitutional law, where I also did my master's degree. Then I joined the South African Human Rights Commission in 1996 as the head of research up until 2004 when I left. And then I joined the commission again in 2005 as the deputy CEO. And then in November 2005, I became the acting CEO of South African Human Rights Commission. I've also spent 4 years at the Law Commission, helping to draft the children's, what is now called, we call it the Juvenile Justice Act, now they call the Child Justice Act. And I've also worked a lot with NGOs on child rights. I was a member of the National Children's Rights Committee, established in 1993, to advance the rights of children. So all in all, Chair, for the greater part of my working life, I've been working on human rights. And I think I have a tremendous experience, if I may say so, for myself. In terms of human rights, I've published a lot, both at the Human Rights Commission and elsewhere. I also serve on the advisory committee of the UCT Children's Institute on children's issues. I also serve as a board member of ODAC on the advancement of promotion of access to human rights. And I think for the last 4 years, almost 4 years, November it will be 4 years this year, I've been in charge of the Human Rights Commission as the Chief Executive Officer. And again, despite all the challenges, we've really done well. We've never really had a terrible audit. We only had one qualified audit last year, a minor one, for not evaluating all furniture which you got from government in 1996. But since then, we've had three unqualified audits. This year, for 2008-2009, we received an unqualified audit with no single matter of emphasis. Actually, that was the second time that happened in the commission when I was the CEO. And Chair, it might be quite controversial, but certainly since I have taken over as the CEO of the South African Human Rights Commission in 2005, I think the commission has become much more known and has done a lot of good work. But I think I'll leave that to yourself as the judge. Why do I want to be a commissioner? It's a difficult one since I'm currently the CEO and a commissioner's post pays less than that of the CEO, and my wife might not be very happy about that. But after 14 years, almost 14 years, working in the Human Rights Commission, I think I've amassed lots of experiences. I've learned the mistakes, as well as I've been part of the successes. And someone says, if you don't know where you come from, you would not know where you to go. And I think with all the commissioners basically who have been there for 14 years living, I think it's important that you have someone who has been involved in this organization for such a long time who will actually help to steer the ship in the right direction. And therefore, I think my knowledge and expertise around human rights issues will help to take this organization to another level from where it is currently. The impact is also linked to my own experiences as a lawyer, as a human rights activist. And I still think that there is a lot more which the Commission could still do around issues of poverty, around issues of working closer with all stakeholders, and also being a bit more courageous than we have. And one thing this chairperson is that you'll also appreciate that since our act was passed in 1996, it still remains unamended and therefore unconstitutional. We don't even have a provision to appoint the chairperson of this commission, legally and strictly speaking. We have the Equality Act, which was passed in 2000, which is not yet in full operation. The ASMA committee also raised concerns around issues of access to information, which might now be taken to another body if Parliament approves the current bill. And again, we've not done much around children's issues, even though I come from that background myself as a child rights activist, and I still continue to play that role.
Thank you very much. Honorable Sart.
Chairperson, thank you, and you've already answered the one question, which is the issue of why you wanted to move as a CEO to commission. But can I just ask, in view of that, and that's a very important issue, you came on board at July 2005 as acting, you took over at a very difficult time where there was a lot of internal dissent in the commission, and you seem to have managed to turn it around and done very well according to reports and what we're aware of from the Justice Portfolio Committee. Do you not think that in view that you're going to be a whole lot of new commissioners that we need a CEO of your standing to continue? In other words, with the background that you've got from the management issues, that experience, and the difficulties in 2005 with the Public Finance Management Act, with the whole issue of corporate governance, do you not see that as a need, first of all? And secondly, if not, do you have a sufficient deputy that could take over, and should you move on to the commissioner's level? And then secondly, you'll recall when you were last here before the committee, one of the big issues related to the relationship of the commission, both with Parliament and with the executive. Let's deal firstly with the executive and the difficulties that the commission experienced in getting responses, both to reports on the realization of socioeconomic rights from the executive, and secondly, the response to complaints and the frustration that commissioners expressed. How would you deal otherwise to expedite both the reporting and the complaints side from the executive, and the issue of the relationship with Parliament? How would you improve that relationship that one could have a great, you know, just your comments on that relationship between the Commission and Parliament's relationship? Thank you, Chair.
Yes. Chair, sitting where I am now, my staff members are divided. Some are saying I'm a steward of the CEO. And some are saying that I must be a commissioner. It's quite an internal debate, even within me. But, Chair, as the current CEO, I still think that I would add more value in this commission, if I was a commissioner, to actually help in making decisions, strategic decisions, which really matter. As a CEO, I make recommendations. We make my recommendations, some of them are never followed by commissioners for reasons which are best known by themselves to a large extent. And at the same time, I still think that, you know, we need to take the organization to a higher level. And therefore, with the experience I have, I'm sure I could contribute in that direction. Now, the CEO is not the commission. My successes as the CEO are largely through the work done by my colleagues, heads of departments, finance. I can't even write a financial statement, so I rely on my CFO. I know very little about HR, so I simply appoint someone approach and deal with this matter. And therefore, really, it's been collective. We have a new deputy CEO who was a director initially with the public protector, and we have faith that he'll actually help in steering the ship in that direction. But even then, I mean, if I become a commissioner, it does not mean, therefore, there'll be a loss to the commission. I think I'll be in a better position, actually, to help both sides of the organization to understand each other. Because one thing we need to acknowledge is that over the last 14 years, one of the challenges that constitutional bodies have been having, gender commission and others, is really finding an appropriate balance between the staff and the commissioners. And I think someone who will understand where the other comes from will actually be helpful to narrow that gap. It's actually one of the reasons why we succeeded since 2005. We minimized the tensions between commissioners and staff, even though there are still major challenges in terms of PFMA, where in terms of our act, our chair is not the executive authority. But we said, listen, for the sake of the organization, we'll ignore those issues as long as we are able to work together and address our differences in a better manner. Now, as far as the relationships, we continuously advise our commissioners to actually engage more with the executive as well as with Parliament, so that at least we understand where the other side is and what is their thinking, and also they understand our side as well, so that at least we narrow the differences and able to work together. Because one of the challenges really is whether people fully appreciate the work of the organization. And therefore, I mean, that's one thing which I'll actually do if I was a commissioner, to actually engage much more actively than I have been. So, for example, in 14 years, I don't recall the Human Rights Commission ever addressing cabinet as a collective. I don't even recall us as the commission meeting with the leadership of Parliament and the Speaker and the chairperson of the NCOP outside committee meetings, just to share ideas. And that's one thing which is lacking. As well as in the private sector, we don't engage with corporate entities adequately, who also play a major role on the direction and role of human rights in the country. At the same time, Chairperson, while the Commission has been fiercely independent, I think in some instances there has been a reluctance in the Commission to use its powers, litigate against government sometimes, not in bad faith, but to actually help people to wake up and do certain things. So, for example, we recommend that, for example, the Commission should actually take government to court to enforce the implementation of the Equality Act. That hasn't happened. And therefore, 8 years later, we have a beautiful act which is not yet in full operation. And we speak to Parliament many times raising these issues, but no movement has happened. And therefore, when we go on radio ourselves, sometimes I do that, and we raise these issues. And people say, but hang on, you guys, you've got this power. Why are you not using it? Why don't you take the government to court some time? Just
thank you.
To
thank you.
Try
thank
the point.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Honorable Smith.
Okay, let me help you by picking up where you were just leaving off. When you say the Equality Act is not fully enforced, are you talking about Section 28?
The
equality
plan? The promotional aspects.
The promotional aspects,
yeah.
All right. Now, Mr. Tsipanyane, won't you help me with a few other things? To what degree did the Human Rights Commission regionalize or provincialize? The last thing I remember is that there were 8 provincial offices, am I right? Was each province assigned a commissioner? How did that work? That is for our later deliberation, to what degree ought one to think of regions at all in appointment? To what degree was it necessary? One other thing, when you last presented to us, you said to us, kindly note that the Commission made budgetary provision for 6 commissioners due to the fact that the Commission cannot afford to have enough funds to cover the salaries of additional 5, including the office furniture and computer equipment. Just remind me, I think you were saying that we can't appoint 11 on the current budgetary allocation. Is that what you were saying? I just want clarity on that. But then let's get to the interesting stuff. One of the things that I most like about your whole CV and your experience is the fact that you sit on the board of ODAC. I know there's a lot else, but when I saw that, I was delighted. because the right to information requires so much more attention. And I think that the Human Rights Commission, which is given certain tasks under the PIA, has never been given the money. Parliament promised that whatever tasks the HRC is assigned to do under the PIA will be specifically funded, and we've simply never given you that money. Right. So now, it's become more and more important, in fact, to look after information because it just isn't working. We know the citizenry is not getting its information. And therefore, the proposal was made in the course of the ad hoc committee, the review, that there should be a specific information commissioner, and you gave us models and costings for two kinds. This would be an information commissioner within the Human Rights Commission. The one within the commission was costed at 5.6 million, and a separate one was costed at 7.5 million. And what I'd like to ask you is this, because I never asked it before. The 5.6 million, does that now include your setup costs? But is that an annual cost to the Human Rights Commission if we set up a full information commissioner? Secondly, you've just referred to a proposal for a whole new information commission. Are you talking about the privacy bill just tabled? Please compare for me the merits of the two, having the information commissioner in the HRC and whatever the Law Commission has brought us. And it's really one question, it's about information. And ask, and then just to get a sense of your thinking, apropos the Castor-Semenya case, what ought we to have on the law book? Ought we to be protecting genetic privacy? Ought there to be an offence for people who invade? And what could the Human Rights Commission do about a matter like the Castor phenomenon?
Thank you, Chair. When I left the Commission and joined the Federal Commission for 8 months, I advised the Commission not to set up provincial offices until they're very clear as to what they want. That has been one of our head legacies in the Commission, as far as our provincial offices are concerned. Because at the beginning, we had assigned commissioners to the provinces, and then there were problems fighting over TEF, because, I mean, it can't just be a geographic allocation and not a thematic allocation. And therefore, you find that if you're not assigned to KZN as a commissioner, you can't deal with issues which come from KZN, even though you might have a better expertise on some areas of human rights and the commissioner who is there. So that was removed. And then we said commissioners must be linked to thematic issues, child rights, equality, across the province. Now, at that level. Now, on the other level, even today, is still a major challenge in the commission, because initially we gave the provincial officers some powers, to manage their budgets, and those were removed. Now, that also has caused problems. And as a result, people feel that, the office of the commission, they're very far from the head office. And those are issues which we're still grappling with as the commission. And therefore, we need to come up with a very clear blueprint. Now, we've heard now with the next term that there's some thinking again to consider whether commissioners should be based in the provinces or be thematic. And we're saying, please, let's talk about those things and learn from the mistakes of the past. It might be a good idea, but then we need to be able to address all the challenges which that model presented over the current model. And therefore, we're not really married to anything. We're only married to what will work and take the organization further. Now, as far as the number of commissioners are concerned, our act is silent about the maximum. It only talks about the minimum of 5 full-time. And since the beginning of the second term, we were only given 6 commissioners, 5 full-time and 1 part-time. And therefore, our budget has always been based on that, because you can't budget for non-existent 11 commissioners. The president decided to appoint only that number, former President Thabo Mbeki, we have 5 full-time, because the act says there must be 5 full-time. And then we had 1 part-time, that's Kathy Government. Now, as we stand now, with the advent, we already have 1 full-time commissioner. So it means 5 full-time and 1 part-time, we will not have the budget for that. We've already gone to Treasury last 2 weeks ago, and we raised this issue to say, listen, you know, you have to give us money. However, we don't know how the President and Parliament will decide. And therefore, if there is more than 6, then we'll have to be given money. And then if they're going to be based in the provinces, then we'll have to give us more money for provincial offices and staff and traveling and everything else. Now, on the right to information, that has also been a challenge for us. One was that the Act actually provided that Parliament itself must provide us with money. That has never happened. So we rely on whatever we get from MTEC, from Treasury through MTEC. As we stand now, we have one staff member who deals with access to information proper. However, you know, through an integrated approach to our work, all other officers of the Commission in little ways do help in ensuring that PAIA remains alive. It's not running, just barely alive. And I think that's why the portfolio committee, the other committee itself, was quite harsh on the Commission that, you know, PAIA is dead because really we have not done enough. So we proposed those two models because the other model was that there must actually be a new commission altogether. If the commission was still divided along that line, but when we came before the committee, we said, well, we propose that there must be a standalone information commissioner in the commission with dedicated staff and budget. Now, the figures we're giving were based on an integrated approach that you're already using the existing buildings we have and everything else. However, if you're going to start from scratch, we'll not be proposing 5.6 million or even 7.5 million. Now, the new bill is quite fascinating for us. We had a discussion only yesterday, actually. Last week, Friday, on this bill, because we're actually going for a strategic review tomorrow and the day after. Now, when we read the Act, the bill, we realized that all our work under PAIA will move to the new regulator if that happens. If we do, yeah. Now, some of us are saying, no, the regulator must actually be in the Human Rights Commission, and we need to make an arrangement for the regulator to be able to be more effective than we have been. The challenge being that if you don't do that, you start the new commission, and already if you look at the CNACs over the last 14 years, there have been challenges, and there's no guarantee that the regulator might, you know, take off. Unless, you know, we take necessary measures to ensure that happens. But secondly, it will take time for the public itself to realize there is a new body which they could go to. But again, you know, it's a debate which we are having. Other views in the Commission is this, listen, we have not done very well on PAIA, so we might as well just give it up. We ourselves failed as a Commission, and we admit that, to basically stand up and fight for this Act meaningfully. And as a result, many people in civil society are saying, well, maybe we need to give this new body a chance outside the Human Rights Commission. Now, our proposal, which we'll be making, is that minus all the challenges about the Act, at least house it in the Commission until it can be able to stand on its own. That it can then decide whether it can. Otherwise, you'll need much more than 17.5 million to actually set up a new body. And secondly, the bill does not even make reference to provincial offices. So you're going to have this regulator sitting in Pretoria or Joburg. Now, what about the provinces and rural areas? How will this work? But of course, someone can say, well, you can always amend those. But we'll be making a formal submission to the portfolio committee once we're given a choice, a chance, and then we'll raise all these debates. But I need to point out that it's going to be a fight tomorrow as to whether we let go or we ask for it to stay temporarily or permanently. So there are those three in the commission which we'll have to debate and see what works. But at the end of the day,
we are beyond schedule now.
Elaborating
on the bill. So.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, Apple is very clear. We'll support what will be in the best interest of this country at the end of the day. As the commission.
Thank you. Honourable Chair, Advocate Chipanyana, three small questions.
Now, the first one is, what have you found to be the biggest challenges that have faced you and the Human Rights Commission over the years? The second question is, please tell the panel what your strengths and weaknesses are. The last question is, you say some of the staff members want you as a commissioner and others want you to remain as a CEO. What do you say?
Thank you. I think the challenges for us as the commission, which we are still grappling with, is really to reach out to rural communities. We've largely been very urban. Even our provincial offices are still urban. And we've tried all sorts of things, including buying caravans to try and reach to the communities. But we are not yet there. But, of course, we are also working with the communities, but not as much as we'd like to do. Secondly, for me, it's our inability, really, to get our own act amended after 14 years. It's unconstitutional, as well as the Equality Act and PAIA. But also our inability to actually get government to ratify the Covenant on Economic and Social Rights, when we are basically saying that poverty and inequalities are some of our challenges in this country. And also to get government to actually report on its treaty obligations, which will then help, to also address our own internal systems. This is linked to our frustrations under socioeconomic rights, where we have this mandate to monitor the progress made by this country around socioeconomic rights, but every time we ask for information, we don't get enough information to be able to, for us to make a meaningful assessment. The stats South Africa early this year came to us to say they only have 40% of indicators required to even assess the progress around the MDG goals. Now, that's quite a serious issue. So it means we have not contributed that much ourselves in getting the necessary framework in our country to be able to monitor adequately the progress we're making in the advancement of human rights. So those are, in a nutshell, the challenges which we are still facing with. And when you go out of the country, people ask us, it's you and the U.S. who have not ratified the Covenant on Economic and Social Rights. Explain yourself. And it's difficult, really, to explain that. Strengths, I would say, I think I'm a very good human rights lawyer and activist. I always say to my friends, just Google me, then you'll appreciate what I've been doing. Over the last 20 years, I've given papers UN, I've been invited to Harvard twice, I've been teaching national security and human rights at the Defense Force College for the last 4 years, where I was given an award as the best lecturer 3 years ago, but not since then, I don't know what has happened. As far as weaknesses are concerned, I'm going to be honest, I was never trained as a manager. I didn't do an MBA. I was just an old traditional lawyer and human rights activist. And when I was asked to be the CEO, to be honest, I was really scared because as head of research, we're not very involved in all these issues of PSMA. We're simply doing research and writing our papers. So it's kind of scary to be a manager and start dealing with issues of finance and whatever. And I had to read very hard on that. So even though we've managed to survive as a commission, but clearly we can't win an award as having the best management systems in the organization, we're still trying to develop that. At the personal level, I want to be very, very, I used to have a very short temper, I must say. There are many people I used to insult when I was young and very rude, and I'm still paying the price for that. I've managed to tone down a little bit. At the same time, then I'm told I'm overcompensating because now I allow my staff members to, put their fingers in my eyes. It's a balance which one has to give. But I must say, sometimes I tend to shoot my mouth. I think the Malema saga was one example where I insulted Mr. Malema on radio, saying he's a nut in the trunk. I later apologized to him. after the intervention of Mr. Jeffrey, who told me off. You know, but I think Ahmed well, because we shook hands with Mr. Malema and Mr. Favi, it was a lesson for us. So now we're a bit more careful, because we need to understand the context in which you operate, that, you know, you don't necessarily annoy people. At the same time, we took a serious hammering for being very soft on Mr. Malema. So
thank you. Thank you for that. You have answered the question, what are you saying? You have answered it earlier on, before it was answered.
Yeah.
So you don't have to answer.
Yeah, my son is delighted that I'm here.
Yeah, thanks.
No, it was a friendly of the local discussion. A brotherly advice, so to speak.
Are you staying here till us? No. What time? I'm going to be there. I can't have a foot out there.
On a lighter note, I see that according to your CV, you were a demonstrator from August 86 to May 87, but then I see it was actually the period of some of the worst uprisings in South Africa. You were a demonstrator, but then I see you were actually at the University of Lesotho, and it was demonstrating for something else. But just on a lighter note, no, I think the point I wanted to make is just a few things. One, I think in the past there's been some tension between the CEO and the commissioners as to who should perform what roles. Do you think it will be a problem, or how are you going to avoid that problem, having been the CEO and then moving into being a commissioner, that you then don't start treading on the toes of the new CEO in terms of confusing the role of the commissioners and the CEO? And then the other main question was the issue of do you see differences between the Human Rights Commission and non-government organizations? In terms of the way that government should be engaged. It's very easy to go head-to-head with government as an NGO, but that's not necessarily the best way of getting things done for the Human Rights Commission. You've talked about now taking government to court and things like that. You're aware, I'm sure, that one of the former ministers of justice was not very happy with the commission because she felt it made a finding against her without giving her an adequate opportunity to respond before the finding was made. You have raised the Malema issue, where I think it is, you know, commissioners need to be careful. They might have views, but they need to be careful, commissioners and CEOs, but they need to be careful about how they project themselves. And to call another citizen of the country, whoever they are, a madman on radio, is not really the best way for a commissioner or a CEO to behave. So I just want to raise those as issues. How are you going to deal with that? That there's a certain amount of diplomacy that is needed. So it's really around the question of the difference between, I mean, you're involved in NGOs, and do you see a difference as to the way the NGOs and should interact with government as opposed to the way the commission should interact?
Thank you. Chair, the first question, the tensions between the Secretariat and the Commissioners really had a negative impact on the organization, if this committee would recall what had happened before then. And also we look at the challenges which the CGE and the Federal Commission were worked, the tensions can actually cripple an organization. And I think the current challenges the CGE is having today is actually part largely due to that. Now, when the CGE was appointed, commissions appointed last year, we really thought they were going to give us a serious run for money. We're actually welcoming that. But certainly, they are hardly in existence. Now, what we did when I became the CEO, I took my commissioners and my senior staff members on a 50,000 rands workshop on corporate governance. So we should know exactly who is who. And we also made it very clear to the commissioners that, you know, we are accountable to the commissioners. The commissioners act on our advice, and the act is very clear. And therefore, even though we can simply say, sorry, you're not executive authority, and therefore we'll do whatever we want to do, that is not in the interest of the organization. So we are quite mindful that if no commissioners come on board, we'll have to sit down with the commissioners and really get everybody to understand what is organization and who is who and who does what. But at the same time, make it very clear and remind our staff members that the act is very clear. The staff members are accountable to the commissioners to help them give effect to their mandate. They are the bosses at the end of the day. The CEO is not the boss of the organization. And that's why I've also been requesting that PSMA should actually be amended so that at least it becomes very clear that the executive authority vests with the commissioners. Yeah, in the regulation, therefore, it creates problems because then it's not really binding, but we act as if it does that. And therefore, that balance will always need to be maintained. But I need to say, Chair, that also we should also be mindful of the tensions amongst commissioners themselves, which can also cripple organizations. But since 2005, we've tried very hard to manage both tensions amongst commissioners as well as tensions between commissioners and staff members. They did happen. If you recall, early in the beginning of the commission, Commissioner Rhoda Kadani actually took us to court as a commission. Commissioner Helen Suzman sided with an NGO to sue us on our finding on foreign doctors. We've been trying to minimize those. Now, the Human Rights Commission is not an NGO. It's a constitutional body, and it must conduct itself as such. And therefore, we can't be shooting our mouth anytime. We worked in a corporate governance, and we as a commission, I want to put my foot down, we have never. We don't ambush government. We don't sue government unless it's a last resort. And therefore, sometimes our failure to take tough measures actually brings us into lots of ridicule by some people say, listen now, you guys are scared. Now, if you recall, when in 1997, when we began our monitoring mandate on socioeconomic rights, many government departments did not even bother responding to us, even though it's a constitutional mandate. So we wrote to them to say, listen, we won't do anything this time. We're just advising you that next time we will. And even when we subpoena government departments, we don't subpoena on the first letter. We write sometimes up to 7 letters, which can also get us into trouble, even with the complainant that, you know, I've been waiting for 6 months because they're busy writing letters which are not being responded. Now, the same thing also happened with the Ms. Mabandla letter. We wrote countless of letters. Well, you see, there's this thing that the commission staff members try to write as many letters to remind people until they say, listen, you know, so some take, some write 7 letters, some write 8 letters, but you'll find on other people tend to write more than 3 letters. And they're saying, listen, we can't be writing many letters, 3 letters at the most. Otherwise, you know, as long as we make sure people have received our letter and they're not responding, you remind them, like, they don't respond, then, you know, start
doing them. I think you've made the point. Anyway, earlier on, you answered the question about how you learned your lessons, not shooting your mouth. So you don't have to go.
Yeah, but Chair, can I say on that matter, I appeared before the Portfolio Committee of Justice, and I explained in what circumstances did I make those remarks. It was unfortunate because what Mr. Malema did, he went at the KZN and accused the commission of not protecting Jacob Zuma. And we felt that actually quite dangerous to be saying things like that to the community when Mr. Zuma had never brought a complaint to us, and this matter was being dealt with by a public protector. In terms of our regulations, we cannot deal with the matter, which is before another constitutional body. But I think we should actually have educated the minister.
Thank you very much.
Then we did
explain that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The obviously, your candidacy as a member of the commission is heavily influenced by your track record as the CEO, and therefore by the track record of the commission, and depending on how one assesses that as a view on the on your suitability. And I want to try to tease out, especially after your last intervention, what you really mean when you said taking the commission to a higher level. I have an enormous respect for your track record as human rights advocate. From the little experience as compared to yours that I do have in that field, I know very well how easy it is to transform human rights advocacy in an endless string of meetings, papers, conventions, seminars, training opportunities, which are all necessary. But the way I assess the work of the Commission, and I might be wrong, and I want your reaction, is basically doing two things: protect the violations of first generation human rights and provide the research and the credibility to set the threshold against which the enforcement of second generation human rights can become part of the judicial process. How much services are people entitled under the Constitution? So that's the core function. And I look at what the Commission has done in the past 15 years in a negative way. I look at the Commission as having been lame, weak, and meek. It's been outperformed by NGOs out there in all the critical issues. It's not been the conscience of the country, whether in the issue of HIV/AIDS, the refugee affairs, the same-sex relationship, the issue of the Dalai Lama, the NGOs that come in, small NGOs like Human Rights, Lawyers for Human Rights, have achieved more concretely for human rights protection in this country than the Human Rights Commission. And perhaps that was necessary for the first 15 years. But my concern is the Human Rights Commission has positioned itself to be one of the guys, be part of the establishment. Well, you want to have meetings with the cabinet, you want to have meetings with the speaker, you want to have lunch with the president, and so on and so forth. Now, I would like to see the Commission doing the work that is done, and that they should be doing under the Constitution. So my question to you is, what is it, from a very practical viewpoint, that the Commission will do in terms of intervention? Is going to say yes or no to what? What are the real priorities? What would you do as a commissioner? So we had discussions here before about virginity inspections and circumcisions, and all of us as politicians need to tread very carefully on many issues. We are in the business of balancing. We are in the business of eggshell dances. Is that your business as well? Or should be your business, not your business of the Commission, just to cut down the rope, the Gordian knot, as the Constitution demands?
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you. Without being controversial, I would like to see any NGO in this country with the same budget we do, we have, with the same mandate, which actually does better than we do as the Commission. Because we are responsible for the entire Bill of Rights, and we have a very clear mandate that is to promote human rights awareness, to protect those whose rights are violated, and to conduct research. We get about 8,000 complaints from members of the public a year on human rights violations. We conduct, in the last financial year, 700 workshops in the whole country about on human rights issues. We give 900 interviews a year on human rights issues. Our website has 2 million hits per year at 68 million rights. Not even a single division in government has that kind of impact in this country on human rights. Now, we took very strategic decisions at the beginning. We said we are going to try first and foremost to change the minds of South Africans, to change the attitude of South Africans. We can mitigate, we can do other things, but in the long term, what is sustainable is to change the minds of South Africans, to entrench a culture of human rights. That is still our major focus. And last day, when we looked at the political violence, people were quite horrified by that. But minus the dead bodies, the fact that that violence did not spread all over the country showed that in the last 15 years, we've managed to embrace a culture of respect for human rights in our country. When cross human rights violations happen in this country, many people of this country stand up and raise concerns. Now, clearly, we need to be acknowledged that we have played a role in that. Now, when I was head of research for 8 years, I kept on refusing for the Commission to litigate. We said we'll only litigate as a last resort, because we think it is more sustainable to actually go that route. And therefore, we love the day when actually we could be proven otherwise. Now, this Human Rights Commission we're talking about today, at this point in time, it is the best human rights commission in Africa, and in number 3 or 2 in the world, because what Harvard does last year, maybe 4, they bring about 30 experts all over the world, and we rate this institution. So, I mean, yes, we'll be criticized, when we're not perfect, there are many weaknesses, but clearly I think that most South Africans take pride in the Human Rights Commission. It's not an institution which people look at with shame. They look at it with pride that this is one of the prominent bodies in this country. It's got its own weaknesses, like any other institution. And therefore, having said so, Chairman, I don't think we failed. I think we've done very well as an institution. But I still think that we can take it to a higher level. We need to be a bit hard on government from time to time, and hard on other people, but also be more strategic. We are only 68 million rands, and therefore we should act like that, and therefore be more strategic in our partnership with NGOs, with government, and everybody else. So, for example, we don't even use the post office for you as a drop in center for complaints. In that way, we could actually be reaching to more South Africans. We don't even have an arrangement with the post office to distribute our human rights material. So, I mean, there are other ways in which you could do that. Secondly, for me, even as I've said, I'm a very weak manager, and we still don't have a very clear standard of efficiency in the commission. How efficient are we? And therefore, we need to explore that so that we can become much more effective. But having said so, I mean, we say that all South Africans are shareholders of this company, and therefore they have the right to express themselves as far as our shortcomings are. And therefore, we welcome those. When we run workshops in the community, we ask people to say, tell us, where do you think we are going wrong? And it is through that engagement, and I think, that 15 years later, we are one of the few C9s which are still standing in this country.
Thank you, Sir President. Mr. Tsipanyane, just a few questions. You say you've sometimes written up to 7 letters to government, and yet not getting any responses. Isn't that exactly the reason why people would complain that you are ineffective if you, when you've been given powers by the by Parliament itself, in terms of the law, to subpoena people who are not cooperating? How will they continue to have confidence in you as a commission if you do not use powers at your disposal, when organs of state continue to ignore the commission? Secondly, Chairperson, you commented that you didn't take up Zuma's matter because he had not brought it to the attention of the commission. Just as a matter of interest, do you take up matters only when they have been brought to you, or do you take initiative when complaints are in the, or rather when violations of human rights, not necessarily saying that there was a violation or anything regarding the president now, but what I'm saying, do you take them up or do you wait until they've been brought to you, especially if they are in the public domain? You said one of your challenges has been to reach out to rural areas, and what do you intend to do to ensure that this doesn't continue to be a challenge, but something that is overcome, because these are the people who need these human rights protected more than anybody else. On the matter of these other topical issues like circumcision and problems around circumcision, virginity inspection, and ukuthwala, what do you believe should be your approach? For instance, some people are saying these practices must be done away with because they violate the dignity of young girls, or they bring harm to the health of the youngsters. Others say, no. These practices have a certain way in terms of which they are supposed to be conducted, and that therefore people should be educated on the best way of carrying them out. What is your position in this regard? You said, lastly, Chairperson, the Act needs to be amended so that it can be in line with the constitution, as the commission, have you taken the trouble to draft the necessary amendments that you believe need to be made to the Act so that it is in line with the commission, and given them over to the department, and what has been the response of the department if you have done that? I wanted to ask the person as the final last question, the matter of your, as a commission, not having had a briefing of any kind with the cabinet and also the presiding officers of parliament, what can you say has been the reason for there not being that kind of an interaction at that level?
Too many questions, I want clinical answers.
Thank you, Chair. The seven letters are still part of the challenges we're having the commission as to when to be hard and when to be soft. And actually, I've advised my government that we can't be writing more than three letters, really. It's not acceptable. But having said so, I still think that man has all those challenges. The majority of South Africans still have confidence in the Human Rights Commission. In 2007, it was 60%. Still higher than the Constitutional Court. But it could be better, definitely. On the Zuma matter, yes, we are proactive and we are reactive as well. However, on the Zuma matter, immediately when this development happened, they went to public protector, so we could not get involved. Having said so, however, the coordination, due to its small size, has to be very strategic as to when it gets into an issue and when it doesn't. So we try by all means to avoid matters which have a political tone to it, because we believe there are other structures which can deal with that. However, if it's a serious human rights violation, then we will. That's why, for example, against all advices, we decided to take Mr. Malema and Mr. Bari on their shoot to kill. There was no complaint brought to us. We just felt that those kind of utterances, even though Mr. Malema might not meant what he said, but they have another impact, and therefore that has to be addressed. And of course, we took a serious battery, Mr. Vari, Mr. Blade, and the public, but we stood our ground. The same thing with the FBJ matter, where we took a ruling that black journalists cannot exclude a white journalist from a private briefing with Mr. Zuma. Again, that was a very unpopular decision, but we took that. Now, and therefore, that's where really the issue of leadership comes in. You know, when you choose to do something and when you don't, and then you pay a price for either way, depending on other, and therefore someone must take those decisions, and that's what leadership is all about at the end of the day. Now, rural areas, we are currently working on the Eastern Cape on Okutwala. We've just signed a funding agreement with UNFPA and the Department, the Ministry of Women and Children. We'll be running workshops to raise awareness on that. We're even talking about another $500,000 funding next year with UNFPA to actually try and do that. So we are very clear that, there is indigenous, the Declaration of Indigenous Peoples' Rights, and therefore customary issues are part of this country, and therefore we need to find an appropriate balance. That's why, for example, we did provincial hearings on initiation schools with Federal Commission and the House of Traditional Leaders. Unfortunately, we asked Federal Commission to write the report, and the report doesn't come, and we keep on fighting them to say, listen, this is actually unacceptable. We've organized a number of workshops around issues of customary law, indigenous law, and human rights. We're now head of research, we're actually commissioned by the former Department of Provincial and Local Government on the rights of indigenous people, which we did. And we also went abroad to present that kind of finding. Now, so we are quite concerned. I mean, we're told about 18 to 20 million South Africans live under customary law, and therefore we can't just pretend that they don't exist. That's why we also made submissions on the traditional court bill to say, listen, we need to raise the level of awareness and the rights of rural communities, as well as traditional or cultural communities in the commission. And we also have links with the traditional House of Leaders as well as the council. I mean, I and the government have gone to a number of the provinces meeting with the provincial House of Traditional Leaders to say, listen, we need to find a way in which we can work together. Of course, sometimes we'll disagree on certain issues, but in the whole, I mean, we're all about advancing the rights of our people. Now, as far as our act is concerned, I mean, we have made numerous submissions to this portfolio committee about our concerns. Last year, we made submissions to Justice Department on our act. This committee itself had ordered government to actually amend our act by last year May. It never happened. We've made submissions on PAIA as well. Now, the challenge then is, after 14 years of talking, why is the Human Rights Commission not going to court? Because we've tried everything else other than that. And now, of course, that also then becomes another issue on that. Cabinet, I don't recall the commission actually writing to cabinet for a meeting. But I must say, it's sad for us that 14 years later, we've never had a president of this country visiting the Human Rights Commission. And we wonder why. The former Minister of Justice never set a foot in the commission for 5 years, Madam Mabanza. We don't know why, but at least early this year, Mr. Enver came to the commission, Mr. Martinez came to the commission, Dalama came to the commission, so then we need to address that. But I think what happened also on our side at the beginning was that, and we need to admit, Chairperson, at the beginning, most of us came from NGOs, so we're more like NGOs instead of also realizing that we need to speak to government as well and say, listen, we are partners, and we need to understand what you're thinking, so that at least we minimize the issues. And therefore, another issue which we still have to do as the commission itself, right? I know the end of this year we did write to the speaker for a meeting, but we're told the speaker is still settling down, so we're still waiting for that. But at least on that one we've tried, you know. So maybe when time comes, you know, we will. But I think it's crucial that the commission must meet with relevant stakeholders, so that at least we understand each other and we don't really fight unnecessarily. Because, I mean, it's not in our interest also to get involved in endless and meaningless fights when there's so much which has to be done in our country about human rights.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. You are at least...